Welcome to Them Before Us on American Family Radio, where we strive to put children before adults. Our goal is to educate the public on a child-centric perspective of marriage and family and represent the rights of children on policy matters. Now, here's the host and founder of Them Before Us, Katie Faust.
Welcome to Them Before Us Radio. I'm your host, Katie Faust, founder and president of Them Before Us, and I'm joined by my executive director, Josh Wood. And we're going to cover some of the highlights that we have been addressing over the last several months, cultural, social science breakthroughs, court decisions, to kind of recall what has been happening in the world of children's rights since 2025 began. But first, we're going to start with a little bit of Bible time. And I recently rediscovered a passage that I think is absolutely so brilliant as it relates to marriage and family. But a lot of people don't necessarily know that this is something that drills down to the essence of mothering and fathering. So I just want to read it to you. It's from 1 Thessalonians 2. And Paul is talking about all of the different ways that he ministered to the people of Thessalonica. And he said, "We were gentle among you, like a nursing mother taking care of her own children. So being affectionately desirous of you, we were ready to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our own selves, because you had become very dear to us." So what he's done here is he's actually articulated something about mothering and motherhood that I don't think is captured anywhere else in Scripture. And he absolutely puts his finger on the distinctives that women bring to the marriage and family project: affection, nurturing, and then this entire self-giving. Like, I am going to pour myself out like a drink offering on behalf of my children. Like, welcome to motherhood. It's not something that we choose. It's just something that naturally happens when they put the baby in our arms. But then he goes on to say, "For you know how, like a father with his children, we exhorted each one of you and encouraged you and charged you to walk in a manner worthy of God, who calls you into his own kingdom and glory." So now he contrasts his behavior with what goes on typically in the role of father. And what does he say? He doesn't say that they were desirous of them. He didn't say that they were like gentle among them. He says, no, we exhorted you, we encouraged you, we charged you. And that is a pretty good encapsulation of what not just biblical fatherhood, but just healthy fatherhood overall is going to involve. Men more naturally are going to challenge their children, push their children to take appropriate risks, call their children to a higher standard of behavior, not necessarily through like nurturing and loving and swaddling and kissing, but through a kind of, what he says here is an exhortation, where there is a very clear standard, and he calls the children to that standard. So interesting in the sense that he hit on a pretty fantastic natural definition of motherhood and fatherhood done well. Obviously, we're going to see that in our home, but also we can display both of those in our discipleship relationships. Josh, any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, I think culture always swings between the two, right? It's like the feminine, I mean, we just talked the other day about how the new Netflix series is trying to turn Aslan into a girl, which A, it's just not true to the story, and B, Christ, who is the Aslan, is the Christ figure, was incarnate as a man. And so, you get the two extremes, right, where culture is trying to feminize Jesus, but then also, we can't go the whole, you know, traditional gender role so far down where we don't recognize that God in Scripture is often, or is portrayed, I don't know if it's often, portrayed as a woman. There's the female characteristics, I should say. That's not taboo to talk about. I love how Christ talks about how he has a motherly longing to gather Israel like chicks underneath his wings. That's a very, very feminine picture. We can't be afraid of that. Now, we've got to balance, right? We don't need to turn Aslan into a girl either. But to recognize that that God brings both in fullness to our relationship with him, and that he has characteristics of both, is very good. They're complementary characteristics, and we don't need to shy away from that.
Yeah, agree. Well said. And we need to, you know, the only remedy for this in terms of going astray in one direction or the other is saturation in the Word of God. You just continue to press into the Lord by seeking Him throughout all 66 books so that you can get these balance exactly right and you don't fall into the trap or the snare of anybody who is erring on either one side of these really critical conversations about male and female. Well, we are going to do a bit of a recap over this segment and the next segment over critical things, new trending news items, or court decisions that have taken place over the last 10 weeks. And I want to kick it off with something that we were pretty, that we were tapped for response to in terms of our cultural allies. And that was the executive order that Trump signed to expand IVF access. And you know, his press secretary came out and said, promises made, promises kept, because on the campaign trail, President Trump did talk about how he wanted to be the father of IVF because he wanted, quote, more babies, which, can I get an amen to that? I want more babies too. We just can't do it in a way that victimizes children and violates their rights. So we created a statement about the impact of expanding IVF access and how that would implicate and harm the rights of children. It was something that was picked up by a variety of different allies and quoted in several different trending news stories about that coverage. And where are we at with that right now? We are in a bit of a 90-day wait period where the White House said, we're going to take a look at this issue and we're going to come back with recommendations. So what do you think is going to happen, Josh, when they do finally come back and say, here's what we decided to do to expand access to IVF? Do you have some thoughts?
Well, I will tell you what the impact of this executive order has been already, and that's states feeling like they have to pass legislation to stay in alignment with the Trump administration, that we're carrying out his legislative agenda on a state level. And all of this got kicked off because, again, it's good to go back to the root. In Alabama, the state passed the state Supreme Court said that whether you're in the womb or you're in a test tube, at day three of your life frozen, that you're a person and you have rights. And that anybody, whether it's a bad actor, it's a mother, a father, or doctor, they have to respect the personhood of that embryo. Now, everything that's happened since then has been a reaction to that fundamental truth, which you will hear from us at Them Before Us all day long. That absolutely, those embryos need protection. They are from conception a life, and they are made in the image of God, period. And we don't think that that's disputable. Now, if everybody around us in the fertility industry, mothers and fathers seeking to have children, if they can't live with that, that tells you everything you need to know about the industry. Because people will always come to us and say, well, what is Trump going to do on this? Or how is the industry going to react to this? And is the industry good or is the industry bad? Well, I'll tell you, one thing that's crystal clear is that whether you are on day one inside your mother's womb or in a test tube or whatever, or you're frozen 10 years into being frozen, you're a person and you have rights. Life has already begun. And we can't allow anybody's desire to have children to violate that fundamental truth.
You know, his executive order was not necessarily meant with choruses of, oh, wonderful, this is fantastic. There were really some prominent voices in the media world and even people that were kind of administrative adjacent to him that said, I don't think this is the right way to go. I think that actually this is running up against a lot of the MAHA, Make America Healthy Again, principles. And so I wonder if in the midst of this 90-day kind of gathering information period, what we're going to see at the end of this is something more muted and hopefully something a little more holistic that addresses the root causes of infertility that is leading so many people to seek IVF treatments and not necessarily some kind of federally funded expansion or subsidizing of the IVF industry.
Well, what we all could have gotten behind wholeheartedly is we want mothers everywhere who want to have mothers and fathers who want to have children. We want them to be able to do that. And so whatever is preventing them health-wise, we want to dump money, time, energy this country has to getting them healthy so they can bear children. Everyone would have said absolutely. What we've honed in on is one very specific, quite inefficient process that costs lots and lots of little lives. And we've honed in on that and made that the issue. Again, to your point, I think we need to step back and say, what we really want are healthy men and women who get married, choose to have kids, and have the health care necessary to fix any underlying issue that would cause them or prevent them from being able to start a family. I think that's what we want, and everyone can get behind that.
100% agree. You know, those issues of IVF and abortion fundamentally deal with protecting children's right to life. But there are other fundamental rights of children that have been under attack and that have been protected by a few different state decisions. One of them is children's right to an intact, unmedicalized body, their right to have sex-segregated sports or locker rooms or changing rooms. And we saw a win in Iowa when their governor, Kim Reynolds, signed a bill that removed gender identity as a protected class under their civil rights code. So this is very good because gender identity, this feeling that you might be a boy trapped in a girl's body or a girl trapped in a boy's body, or you're just adopting an identity so that you can usurp female scholarships, or you are a subpar pole vaulter in the JV men's league, and you want to be the top pole vaulter in the women's varsity league. And so they correctly removed gender identity as a protected class. It is not the same thing as race. It is not the same thing as religion. It is not the same place as nation of origin. This is something that is mutable, chosen, and fluid, and very often adopted, not because there's some major underlying issue, but because there are advantages. And even something that has been used by predators at different points to gain access to female spaces. So this was absolutely a win in Iowa.
Yeah, I don't think anyone can disagree that we need to be able to separate people based on whether they were born a boy or a girl, whether it's a sleepaway camp or it's a volleyball game. I mean, this just seems so common sense, which, again, it's shocking to me that this has felt like a hill worth dying on for so many in this country, that we need to have boys be playing with girls. Again, I just think that it's not a winning issue, and it's more importantly, it victimizes children. And I'm glad that we're moving in the right direction.
Yeah. Maine is going in the opposite direction. The governor of Maine has had some public sparring matches with President Trump, where they required that they sex segregate sports and locker rooms and things like that, and refuse to push gender ideology in schools. Maine has said no, and they are suffering the legislative and executive consequences for it. And this is a big problem. You know, my son, who's very wise to the wily nature of the progressive left in his school, is going through sex ed right now, which I am like, yeah, go. I mean, like, he's a ninth grader and he knows everything that there is to know. And I'm like, feel free to go and push back. You know, you can leave the classes you don't want to leave. I gave him permission to decide. But he's like, Mom, you know, in our sex ed classes, they refer to bodies with penises or bodies with vaginas. And I'm like, why do you think that they're doing that? Why can't they simply acknowledge what every human and society and religion throughout history until historically, like the last 5 minutes, has been able to acknowledge, that there's men and women, that there are differences in those bodies. And it's not just these external organs, that those differences go all the way down to the core of who we are. And recognizing that is not discriminatory, it's actually good, and it leads to human flourishing. So I'm definitely on the side of the Trump administration when it comes to working against Maine in this scenario.
Well, I think the only part where it begins to really get me fired up is when, again, in ninth grade, that for a male, maybe they can feel like the confidence to walk out of a classroom. And this was even in the Supreme Court just recently, this case in Maryland, that's actually preventing parents from being able to opt out of some of these instances. And this is where this runs into it for me, is that now you've actually taken this gender ideology to the point where you are going to intervene on behalf of parents. We actually talked about a law in California that made it illegal this past year to tell parents that they've changed or that you're going to. So they can't, even if they want to include the parents. Maybe you're on that side of the spectrum and you're saying, hey, I agree this child should transition, but I want to include the parent. Well, now suddenly that's even illegal. So I think when it runs into, I have the right as a parent to direct the upbringing of my child, that's wrong.
Exactly right. We're going to be back in a few minutes with more highlights from the past 10 weeks.
Welcome back to Them Before Us on American Family Radio.
I'm your host, Katie Faust, here with my executive director, Josh Wood, to work through some of the highlights in the world of marriage and family and children over the last 10 weeks. Another area that we noticed and applauded was Utah expanding access to adoption records. The law gives adult adoptees access to their original birth certificates without court approval. And this is something that reflects a push that adoptees have been making for decades, that very often, I would say almost universally for quite a while, adoptees would have their original birth certificate sealed, and then upon the adoption, a new birth certificate would be issued with the adoptive parent's name on it. Now, originally, this had pretty pure motivations because there was still a stigma around illegitimacy, and nobody wanted the child to feel bad that they were not being raised by the people that gave birth to them. But ultimately, this was a problem for a lot of adoptees, because even if they were raised by loving, wonderful mothers and fathers, there was still something that those adoptive parents could not give to the children, and that was access to the answer, who am I? Obviously, you take on a new name, you are raised in a new extended family, and there's a lot of blessing that goes along with that. But many adoptees said, there's something more. I want information about the woman that gave birth to me. I want to know the identity of my biological parents. Maybe even I need this information when it comes to having accurate medical records and looking at my own possibilities for certain diseases. And so now, a lot of states are reversing the decision to withhold the original birth certificate from adoptees who want access to that information. And that is something at Them Before Us that we are fully in support of.
Katie, do you think it's interesting that this law would tell you that someone who's adopted has some desire for their connection genetically to the people that created them? And that kind of runs counter to what we hear a lot from people creating children through donor conception, saying, well, that biology doesn't really matter. The kids just want to be safe and loved, and they'll just be happy. It's interesting that this law seems to be a recognition that a lot of kids are growing up saying, it really matters to me, and that's my choice.
It's amazing to me the amount of contradictions that we see between the world of adoption and the world of big fertility. We talk about a lot of them before us. And all of the best practices that we have in adoption, things like today, especially open adoptions, where the child has ongoing access with their first families, versus very often a preference for anonymous sperm and egg donors where the child has no contact with their first family. In adoption, we try to keep sibling groups together. But in the world of big fertility, we often separate half siblings from the same sperm donor or egg donor as that genetic material is being sold to a variety of people across the country or maybe across the world. And so what we see in adoption is, even though it is a situation born of brokenness, it is one that is working to respect the rights of children and keep them as connected as possible to their first family. Whereas in the world of big fertility, we see a total violation of those principles. So yes, it's often the case that you'll see things like DNA detectives where somebody's searching for their missing father, and then the joy and the amazement and the videos of looking at the man who gave them life. And they're like, oh my gosh, we have so much in common. And everybody understands how special and wonderful that is. And then you turn around and you go to big fertility and you're literally selling and purchasing the child's genetic mother or father and cutting those relationships off intentionally. So what's happening in the world of big fertility, IVF, sperm and egg donation, and surrogacy very obviously goes against what almost all of us know to be true down in our gut, which is children belong to their mother and father. And sometimes tragedy prevents them from knowing one another, but we should never commercially or intentionally sever that relationship.
Yeah, just a huge difference between a situation, a tragic situation that is putting a child into a situation where they need to be adopted. That's very different than the intention behind creating this. And by creating it and making laws allowing it, affirming it, saying we're behind you or that this is good or normal or the same. It strikes me, we had covered another story in Montana about an assisted suicide bill, which is interesting to me, that it's, again, another situation where we go outside of the hard and fast black and white moral laws that people, regardless of where you find them, regardless of their ability to contribute to society, regardless of how smart they are, regardless of whether they have possess a condition, whether they degenerated something like Alzheimer's, or they were born with a condition that maybe has some limitations for them, that anytime we go outside of, well, none of that matters, this is a life that deserves to be protected because whether you like it or not, this was made in the image of God, and they will remain that way, even as they are sick or even as they are struggling or whatever, what have you. That this suicide bill, this assisted suicide bill, is essentially saying, well, there are some cases where we should assist in death. I mean, I think that's the language they like to use, assisting in dying or assisted dying. What struck me, this is being contemplated in Montana, and this is how it always happens. It starts with, well, we're going to do this really narrow version of this to allow just the absolute edge case, the most painful, I'm going to spend the next 60 years of my life completely suffering type of person should be able to choose to have the state help them end their life. And then what happens? Again, the bleeding edges, everything starts to creep to where Canada, for example, who passed this type of legislation, I was reading yesterday that it's actually turned into the sixth leading cause of death. That sixth leading cause of death, because it has expanded to include things. And now they're even debating, like in the Netherlands where this passed, should we euthanize someone with autism? Could that contribute to a diagnosis that gets this? I mean, again, it's wild when we go outside these laws, these things we know to be true, how it will creep into nightmare scenarios.
Well, and you want to talk about the same kind of talking out of both sides of your mouth, where, you know, in the world of adoption, we recognize that children want a connection with their biological parents. In the world of big fertility, we can intentionally sever it. You've got the same thing going on in these states and countries that are pushing to legalize assisted dying. And you've got campaigns saying, don't kill yourself. There's always hope. There's resources. And in the same breath, you're saying, but if you're really suffering, we can facilitate taking your life for you. And so you're getting these mixed messages. This is obviously, maybe not obviously, but it is clearly more prominent and more of a danger to people in countries that have government healthcare, where you've got socialized medicine, because you've got scarcity of resources. And the truth is, a lot of the people that might be availing themselves to the assisted suicide option are going to be expensive to treat. Maybe they have significant conditions that require therapy or ongoing medicine, or a lot of different counseling services. And the state would save a lot of money if they could convince you to say, this is a dignified path. This has to do with your control. This is about you having the right to choose. And so that is why I think we are seeing made, you know, medical assistance in dying skyrocketing in Canada, because they can't seemingly do both. They can't pay for all of the different ways that these people need medical help or other kinds of financial assistance and meet their budget. So unfortunately, in a lot of these cases, it is coming down to a financial decision on behalf of the state.
When you go outside these things we know to be true, you end up having to create all of these crazy systems to try to decide moral causes because you've messed up what was an anchor in society for right and wrong. Just like with assisted suicide, where now I have to decide, is mental health a condition that should, is autism, could it be severe enough that someone should be able to end their life? Is poverty, like I don't have any financial outcomes ahead of me that are look good enough for me to want to continue living, so I get to? Again, now we're having to develop this whole built-on strategy to decide these questions when something as simple as all lives deserve to be protected because they're made in the image of God would solve so much of this. We got this again in another case with a Virginian judge who ruled that frozen embryos are not property. When we began creating children in a lab, there was excess. Again, I put that in scare quotes. There were embryos that weren't used, embryos that were again, left over. These are horrible terms for human lives, but some of them have now been locked away for decades. I mean, we are hitting a situation where embryos will be passed on in wills to their genetic siblings. I saw on TikTok the other day an individual who, it was a young lady who was talking about, should I take my siblings out of storage and give birth to them myself? I mean, talk about having to map on a new ethical structure to situations that were previously dystopic. But this judge specifically in Virginia, there was an old law that said embryos are, it was appealing to this law to say, these are goods, these are chattel. It's almost like slavery. And so the judge rolled that back and said, well, they're not property. I don't think they went as far as to say these are persons, but I was like, well, that's really good. We at least recognize that these embryos are not someone's property.
Yeah, he made a big splash, or the original decision made a big splash by using that slavery era law to, in essence, adjudicate the fate of these embryos between two warring divorced parents. One that wanted to give them life, the other one that said, I don't want to be a father, especially with a woman I'm not married to anymore. But I'll tell you what, when you're appealing to slavery era laws to adjudicate the futures of little humans, you really need to question the processes that brought those little humans to be created in the first place. And you have to examine the parallels that allow these two things, slavery and commodifying children through reproductive technologies. What is it that binds those two together? Ultimately, it is the dehumanization of an entire class of people. You saw it obviously with our Black brothers and sisters in the area of slavery, and even in the era of Jim Crow. You are 100% seeing it in the world of baby taking an abortion and baby making IVF. And what is the solution to both of them? It is to recognize that human dignity is bestowed at the moment of conception, regardless of your race, regardless of your age or developmental status, regardless of whether or not you are depressed or have a long-term medical condition that requires ongoing care, that you as a human, just by dint of your biological identity, of being a body-soul unity that begins at the moment that sperm meets egg, deserve protection. You are a full member of the human family, and your rights do not depend on whether or not somebody else decides whether or not you should live or die. You have rights that need to be protected by all of us in society, specifically adults.
Well, one thing that gets me is this is solved when you have simple truths like that, Katie. Now, what happens when, and this is another case we covered, what happens when the ruling elites tell you you're not even allowed to present those simple truths to people? And there was a Supreme Court, thankfully, has agreed to take up a case where it's debating whether minors should even have access to counseling that would help them to feel comfortable with their biological sex. And I think the whole case is around, should we be able to suppress a certain type of counseling because it's being labeled as religious, or, you know, the bad term is conversion therapy. And it scares me when that debate isn't even allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting because a lot of the politicking goes on just in how we name these bills. So, you know, they've decided that a 12-year-old or a 16-year-old that is going to a counselor and saying, I have unwanted feelings of same-sex attraction, or I feel I have this feeling of being a girl trapped in a boy's body and I don't like it. I don't want to have these feelings, or I want to figure out what is going on in me. The counselor is not allowed to say, let's just take a look at maybe some of the early childhood trauma that you experienced, or, you know, you also are suffering with depression and anxiety. Let's take a look at that first. Or, you know, you didn't have a close, loving relationship with your father. There's a possibility that you have these feelings of romantic attraction to other men because you're trying to meet a legitimate need in a sexual way. So none of that is saying you can't be gay, you can't be trans. It is saying, let's take a look at what is going on inside, beyond just kind of the labels that society wants to slap on you. Let's go deeper and see what might be some of the root causes of some of this alienation you're feeling from your own body, or the hunger that you have for connection with the same sex. Now, the other side calls that conversion therapy, and they're doing it for a reason. That is because there were some very cruel methods that some therapists would use in the 60s, 70s, even early 80s to try to convert somebody from being gay to being straight. Sometimes that involved things like shock therapy, or like making people walk with like rocks in their shoes. I mean, like it was terrible and it was cruel. That has not been practiced anywhere in the United States for decades. It is literally illegal. But what they're trying to say is that a therapist who simply wants to align somebody's mind with their body, if the child wants them to, they're calling that conversion therapy. Now, this is a total inversion of what actually is happening in the world of, you know, LGBT therapy, and especially just talk therapy. They'll call surgery, radical surgery, where the child is being chemically and surgically castrated, they'll call that affirmation surgery, right? They're being affirmed in who they really are. But they'll call this simply saying, what do you think the impact of the porn addiction is having on your conception of sex and your connection with other boys or other girls? What do you think that that's having in terms of an impact on you? That's called conversion therapy. And so this is a place where they are absolutely trying to confuse the issue by design and take something that is altogether good and will lead to healthy alignment and human flourishing and degrade it using these sort of smear tactics.
Well, it occurs to me that the antidote for so much of this is us continuing at Them Before Us to promote an ideal. And we always do this between Mother's Day and Father's Day. We recognize what children need. They need their married mother and father raising them in a stable household full of love, comfort, joy, connection. And so if you'd like to join us, again, you can go to thembeforeus.com. Join us at the and not or campaign. That neither parent is optional. It's an and, not an or. You can't just have one or the other. Children need both. You can join us at thembeforeus.com. For this month, we have a match going on that for every new monthly donor we add, if we add 50, we will unlock a $50,000 donation. So we need 50 new monthly donors. Head to thembeforeus.com today to join the movement.
If you'd like to comment on the show, email comments@thembeforeus.com. Once again, here's Katie Faust.
Welcome back to the final segment of Them Before Us Radio. I'm so grateful that you choose to give some of your time over the weekend to thinking about issues of marriage and family from the perspective of what's best for the children. It is something that not a lot of adults have the courage to do. And so we're grateful that you're along with the ride with us. I am joined, as always, during the third segment here with my training director, Jen Friesen, who has spent the last week gathering questions from you, things that you want to have answered about your own life or your own relationships and the things that you're processing in your real life world. So, Jen, thank you so much for joining us today. And tell us what it is that we have to look forward to in terms of Q&A.
Hi, Katie. Hi, everyone. Hope you enjoy these really interesting questions we have ahead. They're a little bit more unique, so I'm excited to get your take on them, Katie. The first question is, my friend and her husband just found out they're both carriers for a rare genetic condition. They're considering using embryo selection to avoid passing it on. Is this a compassionate use of technology or is it a slippery slope?
Ah, tough questions, because some of the genetic conditions that can be passed down are serious, and things that could really change your life or the life of your future children. It's hard to address what those are because there's so many different options. There's so many different ways, you know, some severe, some not so severe. And we actually just met with somebody who does genetic counseling for a profession to learn a little bit more about what genetic counselors do and how they walk people through the process of addressing potential issues or existing issues in their own life or the life of their children. So number one, I would say if they have not already, go talk to a genetic counselor. Really study what it is that is the likelihood of this genetic condition, what the genetic condition would mean if they had a child born through it, and do some preparation around that. But do we use embryo selection for that kind of decision making? I mean, what that would really look like is extracting her eggs, you know, maybe they get 10 and then fertilizing 10 of them with his sperm and then evaluating those 10 embryos to see whether or not some of them are carriers and some of them are not carriers for that genetic issue. And then let's say that two of them were indeed carriers. Well, you're not healing those two. You're not working to use some kind of gene therapy to eliminate that genetic condition. you're going to eliminate the children with that genetic condition. So no, embryo selection is not the right path forward. It's not just a slippery slope. It's the cliff itself. It's not a slide down to something that could victimize children. It is the victimization of children. So you really do, I think your friends should do some serious research about this, really understand the risks or the changes or the adjustments that they would have to make if they had a child with this kind of condition. Sometimes it's not as bad as you think. And a diagnosis is not necessarily a prognosis. And so what you want is you want to make sure you're going into it with eyes wide open, but that you're never doing that on the backs of eliminating children who might have this genetic condition.
Yeah. And you mentioned the genetic counselor gal we were talking to. She gave us some great resources too. So I'll just name them. One is called Imago Dei Genetics. So that's the Latin, I think, for made in God's image. It's Imagodei genetics.com. There was one called BeNotAfraid.net, which is for prenatal testing. And then there was one, fetalconcerns.com. And so those are three resources where you can get some of those answers, but there are also people who aren't just going to encourage you to, hey, this is too difficult, let's abort the child, or, you know, we're going to screen out anyone that might have challenges. So, all right, for the next question, what should I say to my niece who was conceived via egg donation and just found out? She says she feels like half her story is missing. How can I support her without attacking her parents' choices?
It's challenging to know how to answer that question when you don't know the age of the child. You know, if she's 8, you want to validate how she feels, but you probably don't want to say much more than that. You want to hopefully have conversations with her parents and say, you guys need to be really open, really forthright. You need to be the safest place for her to process all of this. You need to give her all the answers that she needs and do it in a way that is age appropriate. But you probably don't want to necessarily go much further than that. You don't want to do anything that would inhibit a full relational contact and openness between her and her parents. If the niece is 18 years old and just found out, obviously you still want to facilitate open dialogue between her and her parents. But you can also do a little more of what I call careful validation, which is saying, you are right to feel this way. What you lost really does matter. I understand that you feel like you've just lost half of your identity. Oh, it totally makes sense that you wonder who your biological mother is and does she look like you and do you have anything in common? Again, you can say all of that without disparaging her parents. And you should say it without disparaging her parents. Hopefully they are going to see sort of the shock and trauma that their daughter is going through and own it. And say, we shouldn't have done this. At minimum, we should not have kept it from you. We are so grateful for you. We love you so much. But we made a decision that was good for us, but not necessarily good for you.
Let's say, because we don't know the age, let's say we're dealing with someone who's like 18 or beyond 18, and maybe her parents are not fans of her going and finding that her biological mom or genetic mom, but she wants to. Is your advice to her to say, hey, that's a good thing to do? I agree with that, even if it puts you kind of against her parents?
That's really tough. I think at minimum, you say, what you're looking for and what you want is what every human child throughout history has ever wanted. And so I think a lot of that is just the validation, because there are going to be a lot of voices in her world. It sounds, you know, in this scenario you've painted, even her parents saying, it doesn't matter. Like, why are you looking for this stranger? We're your parents. We're the thing that, you know, we're the ones that have loved you and changed your diapers and kissed your boo-boos. And like, who is this? I mean, this woman's nobody. She's just a donor. And so that's the message that a lot of these kids get when they discover the identity, when they discover that they themselves have been conceived through a third party, somebody else's sperm or somebody else's egg. And unfortunately, it serves as sort of a form of gaslighting. You should not feel the way that you feel. You should not want what every child has wanted. You instead should want what we want. And so I think that you, as a responsible adult, loves her, has the privilege of saying you're not crazy for wanting this. If it was me and I was in that situation, I would say, take a little time, have a little patience, and spend a little more time talking with your parents about this and see if you can get them on board. Because there might be some shocks to your system. When you do discover the identity of your biological mother, for example, she might say, I want nothing to do with you, which could really be devastating. And it would be great to have the love and support of the people who raised you there, you know, when you take that next step.
Yeah, it's interesting. We've talked about that adoptions now are overwhelmingly open adoptions, you know, 95% are open, where that used to not be the case. And so it's interesting. Most people now think it's pretty normal for an adoptee to want to go find biological origins. And I want to know who my birth mom and my birth dad are. And then we kind of see that switch when we talk about same-sex parents with their kids or donor conceived kids, or then those kids are kind of told it shouldn't matter. And so we kind of need to have a consistent view, like, does biology matter to children or not? And adults, I've seen this, my friends who have adopted sometimes have to sacrifice a lot to try and help facilitate relationship with the birth families. Like, they have to help with good boundaries. They have to make sure birth family knows when different events are and if they want to come. And that can be really challenging and difficult. And I'm sure it feels hard because you don't want your kid to necessarily, it's not like them more, but go over there and be, okay, they're really close when they're your adopted kid. And there can be tensions there. But adoptive families, I think, are more primed to do that than a lot of these other kind of alternative parenting situations are.
What you want to avoid is you want to avoid the child processing and searching on their own. You don't want the child to be figuring this out in isolation. Isolation tends to lead to bad decisions. It makes you vulnerable to bad choices. And so what you want in this scenario or any scenario is, if your child is going through something challenging, you want them to look to you. You want them to rely on you. And sometimes in a situation, especially if it's like a divorce or a same-sex parenting situation, or you did use a sperm or egg donor, a lot of that means giving them permission to say, this hurt me, or I feel like you wronged me. Because if they feel like they need to be in the position of being the emotional caretaker for you, it is going to push them into isolation. And you don't want kids there, right? Even if you made a mistake by divorcing their father or being a single mother by choice or using an egg donor, you need to own it. And you need, and hopefully, I pray, that emotional intimacy will develop between you and your child as a result.
That's good. Okay, third question. Our pastor's daughter is pregnant after a hookup and is considering placing the baby for adoption. Some in our church are treating it like shame or failure. How can we better model what it means to truly value both mother and child?
Well, here again, we've got an example of, you don't want people making decisions in isolation. And women who are choosing to keep the baby after a very, especially if it's a situation where she's pretty well known in the church as being the pastor's daughter, she needs to be rewarded, not validated for the choices that she makes, but rewarded for keeping, for not terminating the pregnancy, and for being willing to, in essence, kind of be a public, she's going to be a public example of a lot of this. She's going to have to go through 9 months of scrutiny. She is taking on a pretty significant social cost to protect this child's right to life. So she deserves a lot of intimacy in terms of emotional closeness from the congregation. I don't think anybody needs to tell that girl, hey, you made a mistake. She's probably telling herself that over and over and over and over. And so you, as somebody that has probably known her for a long time, has the joy and the privilege of saying, you belong with us. You belong with us. You don't have to look anywhere else. You don't have to go outside of this church for support and love. You stay with us. We are going to cheer you on. And maybe even get to the point where she feels like, with the help of her parents, she could raise the baby and keep the baby if she feels like that's what she wants to do. An environment of shame and condemnation is not going to lead her to clear decision-making. And that's ultimately not going to redound to the benefit of the child either.
Yeah, I love, we interviewed organization, I think it was Love Life, and they talk about houses of refuge. And that was a statement that churches would read explicitly once a year, to say, if you are in an unplanned pregnancy, or if any of these situations have happened, you are welcome here. You will have support. And that's not this like progressive liberal thing of saying we don't have boundaries or teaching around what God's ideal for our sexual practice would be, which is within the Christian church, a married man to a married woman, and they have sex and have babies. Great. That is the ideal. And these other things are not the ideal. So it's not pretending it's not a mistake or you didn't mess up, but to say, even though you did, we will support you in choosing life. And so I think that's such a great thing to explicitly share. And like you said, people don't usually need to be reminded that they messed up. But the temptation is that you figure out you're pregnant at whatever weeks, I don't know, 13, 14, and to go get it taken care of so you don't get caught. And then you could have, okay, now I've preserved my reputation, my parents' reputation. And the hard thing is sometimes that seems more plausible than just telling the truth because of what it's going to bring down on your family, you know? So it is a pretty tricky situation, but I like that encouragement that as a church, that's the thing. Some of our sin is very exposed and public, and a lot of our sin is very private and nobody's going to know about it. And we can take the people who are publicly messed up. Well, they're pregnant. We know they messed up. That's a lot worse than what I have going on inside, but you know, God doesn't actually treat it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. And I think that there are, again, two errors that we can fall into as Christians, you know, individually, but also as churches corporately. And it is all justice or all mercy. I mean, you can be a church that just hammers, this is true, this is right, this is good, to the point where people feel like they cannot be vulnerable about the areas where they have sinned or struggled. Or you can err so much on the side of mercy where you don't want people to feel uncomfortable. You never want them to feel like they can't come to you or talk about how they've struggled or their weaknesses or their failures. So you don't mention the justice. You don't talk about the ideal. You do not say that there is an unflinching standard to which we must align. And both of those are errors. If you are hoping to be a biblical Christian or a biblical body, local body of Christ, you need to do all of it. You need to do all the justice and you need to do all the mercy. You don't get to decide. You can't put your foot on one side. Now, that's very hard because most of us are predisposed to either one or the other. Most of us are either sort of like truth tellers or grace givers. And it is hard to do both, especially when one of those is going to stretch us in one way or another. It is often, as my husband used to talk about, like straddling a fence that's a little too high. You've got to keep a toe on mercy's side and you have to keep a toe on justice's side. But man, you are like on your tippy toes and it's so much more comfortable to jump from one side or the other because that would relieve the pressure of having to straddle that fence. But if you believe that God is your God and he speaks through his word, you cannot choose. We all have to do 100% justice, 100% of mercy, 100% of the time. Thanks for joining us at Them Before Us Radio. We'll see you next week.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast do not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.